that I concluded I must not do. It took me a while to think about these issues and reach that conclusion. In the meantime, a series of blows were falling on my community, which ended up wiping it out. Perhaps the final blow was when Digital discontinued the PDP-10 computer. You see, the incompatible time-sharing system was written in PDP-10 assembler language. Its development started in the 1960s, and back then, operating systems were always written in assembler language. So when that architecture was discontinued, all our work, the community's software, turned into dust and blew away. And the only way, well, that was painful enough, just to see almost two decades of work become useless. But worse than that, the only way you could get a modern computer and use it was to sign a non-disclosure agreement for a proprietary operating system. So I couldn't continue working in my field in the way I had been doing it. That depended on being part of a community and using the community's software. What could I do? Well, the most obvious alternative was to adapt myself to those changes in the world, to start signing non-disclosure agreements and using proprietary software. And I'm sure MIT would have had me developing proprietary software because the lab had already started doing that. I thought about that, and I realized that that way I could have fun programming and I could make money, especially if I left MIT and did it somewhere else. But at the end, I'd have to look back and say, I have spent my career building walls to divide people, and I would be ashamed of all I had done. So I looked for some other alternative, and it was easy to find one. I could leave the field of software, do something else. Now, many programmers seem to regard this as unthinkable. They say, the people who hire programmers demand this, this, and this. If I don't do those things, I'll starve. It's literally the word they use. Even in the United States, even today, there are millions of people who make a living not in the computer field. Now, I had no other noteworthy skills, but I'm sure I could have become a waiter. Not at a fine restaurant, I guess, but I could have been a waiter somewhere. Now, one thing about being a waiter is that you're not doing anything unethical at most restaurants. And another is you're not going to starve as a waiter. So I had found a solution to the problem. I found an ethically legitimate way I could cope with my situation. But I didn't like it very much. For me, being a waiter would be no fun, and it would be a waste of my skills as an operating system developer. It would avoid misuse of my skills. Developing proprietary software is misuse of my skills. But it would still be wasting them. So I figured I would look for some other alternative. What can an operating system developer do to use his skills in a way that is ethical, that makes the situation better? And I realized that an operating system developer was exactly what we needed. The problem, the moral dilemma, existed because all the existing operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. So, if an operating system developer were to write another operating system and then say, everybody share this, that would give me and everybody a way out of the dilemma. It would give people an ethical way that they could use a computer. So I concluded that I had been elected by circumstances. I was aware of the problem. No one else was going to solve the problem if I did not, and I had the necessary skills to have a good chance. Clearly, this was more important than anything else I could possibly do with my life. I had to do it. I decided that I would write a free operating system or die trying, presumably of old age. That's supposed to be a joke, but... So I decided I would develop a free software operating system. But that led me immediately to a bunch of technical design decisions. What kind of operating system should it be? I had just seen one operating system turn into dust and blow away because it was written for a specific computer architecture that was discontinued. I didn't want that to happen again. Clearly, this system had to be portable. There was just one portable operating system that I knew of at the time, and that was Unix, or at least one successful portable operating system. And Unix had some good ideas by the standards of the time, things like pipes and redirection of I.O., shell programming, fork and exec system calls that were simple enough people actually used them. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. I figured that would give me a good chance of succeeding in making an operating system that would really work and really be portable. And beyond that, I decided I better make it compatible with Unix. Why is that? Because users don't like incompatible changes. To the user, that's a big cost. I realized that I could design my dream operating system using the best ideas from all the systems I was familiar with, plus my own favorite ideas. But if I got this system to work, the users would have said, "Oh, this is very nice, but it's incompatible. We've already trained our people to use Unix. It would be a lot of work to switch to your system, so no thanks." Well, that would have given me a good excuse. I could have said, I offered them freedom, they didn't take it, it's their fault. But I wanted to make more of an excuse. I wanted to build a community where there would actually be people enjoying the benefits of liberty and cooperation. So I realized I had better develop a system that people would actually use. So I realized I should make it compatible with some popular system. At the time, the obvious best choice was Unix. In fact, it still is. I mean, you can hardly consider Windows as an alternative. But anyway, it turns out that the design of Unix was that it consists of many different components that communicate using interfaces that were more or less documented. So to be compatible with Unix, you had to use the same interfaces and replace each component, which meant that all the initial design decisions were already made. Except for one, what range of target machines should we try to support? Now, Unix was designed to support 16-bit computers, but supporting those machines is a lot of extra work because you have to keep every program small. You have to keep the data space of each program small, too. And it's a lot of extra work to do things that way. So I decided to make the job easier, because the job was obviously very large. To make the job easier, we would only target 32-bit or better computers. I figured it would take several years to get the system running, and by then, everybody would have 32-bit computers. And indeed, that's what happened. So the design decisions were made. The only thing we needed was a name. Now, we hackers generally like to find funny or even mischievous names for programs, because thinking of the users laughing at the name is half the fun of writing the program. So, we had a hacker tradition that when you're writing a program similar to some existing program, which you had to do fairly often in those days when the programs were not portable, you could give your program a name, which is a recursive acronym, which says that this program is not the other one. For instance, there were many TECO text editors in the 60s and 70s, more or less compatible. And most of them were called something or other TECO, but one clever hacker called his program TINT, for TINT is not TECO. first recursive acronym. We loved that so much that we made lots of others. In 75, I developed the first Emacs programmable text editor. And there were many imitations, some of them called something or other Emacs, but one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And there was Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And there was Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. Then Ina was almost completely rewritten, and the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So you can have a lot of fun with recursive acronyms. I decided to look for a recursive acronym name for something is not Unix. I tried the obvious four-letter possibilities and decided that none of them was funny because none of them was a word. So I said, well, how else can I do it? And the only thing I could think of was to make a contraction so that I could get a three-letter recursive acronym. And I started trying letters, Anu, Bnu, Knu, Dnu, Enu, Fnu, Gnu. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language, so that had to be it. Well, why is the word GNU so funny? The reason is, according to the dictionary, it's pronounced new. So there's always been a lot of wordplay about that word. The question, what's GNU, is much older than the GNU system. There's even a funny song based on the word GNU, which... I think I actually have a recording of it. I might be able to play it at the end if people are interested. But anyway, I don't remember if I have it on the computer or not. We'll see. But I should point out that it's actually a loan word from an African language, and the correct pronunciation has a click sound in it. The European colonists didn't bother learning to pronounce the click sound. They just left it out. And they wrote the word with a G, meaning there's another sound here that we are not pronouncing. And then those both got put in the dictionary, and people started saying that anything else was wrong. So, when it's the name of our operating system, please pronounce a hard G. Pronounce it GNU. In some countries, people say that's difficult. I suppose it won't be hard for you, though. If you call it the new operating system, you'll get people very confused because we've been working on it for 18 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is and always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So...